This podcast is sponsored by Rode Microphones, the choice of today's creative generation. Small HD, real-time confidence for creatives.
Hi everyone, this is George Edelman, editor-in-chief at No Film School, and I am here recording another podcast roundtable with the team on the ground here at Sundance 2020. Let's go around the table and quickly reintroduce everybody.
I'm Oakley. I'm a writer at No Film School here on the ground with the team.
I am Emily, and I have worked for No Film School before, and I am back working again, doing Sundance, and very happy about it.
You can't quit us. I'm Ryan Koo, and I am No Film School.
We're here. We're still seeing all kinds of stuff, meeting people, talking about things. And I feel like everybody's had a really busy couple days since we last checked in. And I've heard from each of you anecdotally about some amazing things you've seen and some serious emotions that have come through. Let's be honest, it's been an emotional stretch since we recorded this podcast, maybe more for some than others, but we literally finished recording our last Sundance podcast when Ryan announced to us the news that Kobe Bryant died tragically with his daughter and others. And I, for one, was deeply affected and shocked. And we went right from there to an ESPN party, which we weren't even sure would be held. And the mood was surreal, I would say. It's hard for me as an Angeleno not to have been in Los Angeles during this. The city is, I can't compare the impact of this, the way I'm seeing it in the media, in my feeds, in texting. It's just been bizarre. But that's not what we're here to podcast about. I do wonder if it seeped into some of the emotions that have been coming through in some of the films and some of the experiences people have been having. So I just want to open it up because I know you guys have seen some things that really touched you. Maybe it has nothing to do with the external events, but I'll go right to Emily because I know you have a story like that and what you've seen. And then let's just talk about our festival analysis in general, but let's start with what we've seen that's really impacted us since the last time we spoke.
So I saw The Father. It is a Sony Pictures Classics film, and it stars Anthony Hopkins as an elderly man who is suffering from dementia. So the Father was written and directed by Florian Zeller based on his really critically acclaimed play that has been across the world playing for about 7 years. We're going to interview him tomorrow, so I'm really excited about that, and you can check it out on the site within the next week or so. So the film is extremely devastating for anyone who's worried about having to take care of their parents as they grow old or growing old themselves. So basically any person on this planet who has a heart. really horrifying. It puts you directly in the epicenter of the subjectivity of Anthony Hopkins' character as he experiences dementia. So the whole narrative is built around making you feel just as confused and just as, angry and stubborn and attached to his apartment as what it looks like to see a loved one suffer from dementia from the outside. They do that by writing different time loops into the script. So things are constantly changing. Sets are changing. Actors are changing. He doesn't recognize his daughter because she's suddenly a new actress. Suddenly details of her life are different, and her husband is played by, a different actor. And then, she's been divorced for 15 years. Facts of the existence and his reality are flipping constantly.
You know, what's really cool about that real quick is that we talk a lot to people. We've talked to programmers and we talk to people about what Sundance looks for, and they often talk about perspective. And I think it's interesting to hear that the movie was made from the perspective of the person who's suffering, because I saw a movie also that was made, the structure of the movie, the cinematic language was affected by the perspective of the character who was suffering from, a descent into a psychological, bipolar or something extreme. And I think that was Horse Girl. And I think that that's an interesting way to tell a story. And I think that Sundance highlighting things like that and creating an emotional experience is part of what a festival like Sundance is supposed to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a really strong film, and it's going to do really well. And I think it's I compared it to Michael Haneke's Amour because it is similar in the emotional effect, and it's sort of thematically similar too. But it's much more creatively affecting than even that movie.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it takes a little bit at Sundance to find the great films. And I think when we've recorded our first couple, it was such a madhouse that, it, you know, the first time I'd seen one movie, and the second time we talked a lot about the industry and yeah. the festival.
And not everything is screened at that point either.
Right.
Exactly. And I still have movies to see. But I've seen 16 movies now in 3 or 4 days. And
you win.
and none of those were screeners. Those are all like you got to go somewhere and get into the theater. And I've seen some remarkable films. I mean, some of the best movies I've ever seen have been here. And so at first it's like, oh, why is this movie at Sundance? Because you might just go to one movie and
yes.
you know, it disappoints you. And since then, out of the 16, you know, five maybe have just blown me away. So as we record this, the Sundance Awards have not been announced and so on and so forth. You know, I guess some news about acquisition prices have started to trickle in, but I really want to focus on some brilliant films that are here, which inspire you as a filmmaker because, you know, they're so imaginative and they're so emotional that it makes you realize what's possible. And also just for the festival to put a spotlight on something like these great films where it's at the Eccles and there's 1,200 people and it's sold out and it's not even the premiere, you know, like that's
yeah.
that's an amazing feeling and it's an amazing way to experience great films. I want to focus on the Asians, my people. Shout out to the Asians. There are some movies here that I haven't had a chance to see, which are either, you know, written or directed or starring Asian Americans or Asian Canadians or any kind of Asians. But there are two films that I saw in the last couple of days, which I think are some of the strongest at the festival. You know, maybe I'm playing favorites, but I just came from Minari, and you're going to hear about this movie for the rest of the year. It's going to win awards. It's going to win awards here at Sundance. It's one of the most emotional experiences I've ever had watching a movie.
No way.
And it's so good. So it's written and directed by Lee Isaac Chung. It's about his experience growing up in rural Arkansas as a Korean in the 80s, and it stars Steven Yeun and I think both the, I don't have it in front of me, but the actor playing the young son and the actress playing the grandmother should both win supporting Oscars. I will say that right now.
How young is that son?
The kid is like, I have no idea. He's like 5 years old.
Oh my God.
And there's just like lingering close-ups of him. You know, it's not like, oh, we got to cut this performance together. Like he's so good. Also, everyone knows Asian babies are the cutest.
Oh, yeah.
So,
unequivocally.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Wait,
also,
that's controversial?
I don't know.
Also,
no, when I was in Japan with my boyfriend, I kept saying that, and he was like, Emily, what are you going to do if you don't have Asian babies?
Ha. There's
I mean,
a joke.
Look,
there's
weird.
A joke in my feature, actually, in the very first scene. Somebody says, oh, you're like one of those cute little Asian babies all grown up. It's a good line.
All grown up, though. Ooh.
Yeah, yeah.
So Minari, you know, keep tabs on that one. Unfortunately, we don't have an interview coming, but we'll try to do one when the film is coming out. They shut me down.
It's A24, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A24 has been doing that. They also know when they have an ace card. And
yes.
like, if it's not going to come out for many months,
an ace
an awards play.
I'm so bad. That's becoming my thing. Those jokes.
That would be
the dad,
that would,
dad jokes.
That,
oh, shit.
You are dad.
It happened.
That would be a bust, though, right? Because you're trying to get to 21.
Yeah, yes.
Be over.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Minari, and then the other one I will highlight is 9 Days, which is written and directed by Edson Oda. It's not a film about any particular specifically Asian issue, but the premise is so conceptually brilliant. It is about souls interviewing for the chance to be born, and it's absolutely universal in its depiction of what it is to be human and what it is to live and have the opportunity to experience things or to have that taken away from you. It's a pretty starry cast. It has Winston Duke from Us and Zazie Beetz and Bill Skarsgård, who you might recognize as It, and Benedict Wong, who most recently most people know from the Avengers series. The performances are amazing. It's a Sundance Labs project, and it's one of the most ostentatious debuts. I mean, you're going to make a movie about souls interviewing to have
high
a
concept.
Chance to be alive, and it's going to be set in the salt flats of Utah. And the point of view of living people is depicted as VHS tapes on, you know, vintage televisions. I mean, it's really, it's the kind of movie where you feel like a festival to celebrate the arts, this is the kind of thing that should be here. And I got a standing ovation. I was at the premiere. So I think Minari and 9 Days are going to be two movies to keep your eyes
there's
out
a,
for.
It's funny. There's like a subgenre of movies about like... not just the afterlife, but like the souls when they're not in bodies.
The purgatory.
Yeah, or like, and it's not always in the pejorative purgatory sense, but I'm blanking on some of the names, but there's one that's been remade a couple times, and Warren Beatty was in the 70s version. There's
Good Place.
There's the Albert Brooks movie. There's also The Good with Meryl Streep. There's also The Good Place. There's also Here Comes Mr. Jordan, which I think is Cary Grant. Anyway, there is an interesting subgenre. It'd be interesting to do a study on that, but anyway.
I think a lot of those movies, though, traditionally, you've had sort of high concept Hollywood movies that explore that type of thing. And what I want to point out about Minari and 9 Days, and what's maybe different about them, is how personal they are.
Yeah.
The writer director Edson Oda talked about for 9 Days what inspired him was his uncle committing suicide. And with Minari, Lee Isaac Chung, he lived that life growing up in this rural place where they were, you know, that they stuck out like sore thumbs as the only Asians. And as an Asian who grew up in the South myself,
I was gonna say,
maybe I'm biased.
I was going to say.
I might be biased, but I don't think I am.
Well, it sounds like it's a good movie that's doing well, so it's not just like you're like coming out of left field with this thing you found. Like, hey, it's my story, and it's amazing.
No, I heard Minari was incredible. But what, interestingly, there's been this. I feel like this happens in general, but at this Sundance, this has been happening more anecdotally to me than it has in the past. And let me know if you guys agree. There are people who have completely bipolar, radically different experiences of movies. Like 9 Days is getting very mixed reviews. People either love it or hate it. And I was in the middle of a conversation with people duking it out about 9 Days. I also had that experience with The Knower, and I hated it. And I saw it with other people that loved it. And we just were like, did we just have the same experience? Were we in the same dimension watching that movie?
I heard some, like, not negative, but I heard some meh kind of things about 9 Days. Interesting to hear Ryan talk about it, because the way Ryan describes it, it sounds like it's extremely interesting from a construction standpoint, just from the pieces that are put together. So
I think what often happens with the movie that checks all the boxes for the most of its runtime, right? Like, where you're on board with it, it's successfully suspending disbelief, you're into the performances. If there's a ending that people are polarized over, often a movie that you loved up until that point, if you didn't like the ending, then all of a sudden you're like, this is the worst thing ever, when really the fact that you're that passionate about it is still a compliment to the film. And I do think people seem to react differently to the ending of the film. Obviously, if you're up until the 80% mark, you're so wholly captivated by this thing. It's still an incredible movie, and it's just not going to be for everybody.
I think also before you go, Oakley, I think it's worth pointing out that movies that polarize belong at festivals, because we want to see things that touch us. It's about perspective and POV and something that can connect with somebody uniquely, but that can also maybe miss somebody, or that they can at least be, I didn't get it, or I don't get why, because that's kind of what art is. Like, we're not going to necessarily see that in the multiplex, because they're trying to hit more people. So when we come to a festival, what we hope to experience is something that's a little more targeted and that is a little more unique and maybe messy and not quite right on the money, which I think for our listeners and for filmmakers who read No Film School, if that's what you want to do, if you want to have a voice and you want to say something specific and you think it might not fit all the boxes, like, that's the purpose here, at least, or at some festivals.
I completely agree with that.
Cool.
Yeah, so speaking of films where audience members are taking away completely different things from the screening, George and I had a chance to see Downhill.
We did.
Which is a remake of the 2014 film Force Majeure, which I was really excited to see, and I am really excited to see what people think about it. One thing that we said going into it is, how could you possibly remake a film so good? And it is sort of an impossible task. And so watching Downhill was like a complete like mixed bag. And I think it's definitely one of those ones where the people who loved Force Majeure in the audience were like, no, it's not the Force Majeure I love, which it just isn't. It's in a lot of different ways. And then the rest of the audience, we were like, well, what do people think that haven't seen it? And so I had a chance to talk to a woman who just randomly on her own accord brought up, I just saw Downhill. It was great. I loved it. And I was like, oh, you know, did you ever see Force Majeure? And she didn't know
right. That
it had been a remake.
Right. Yeah, sometimes. So my anecdote with that is always The Departed and Infernal Affairs, because Infernal Affairs was this amazing foreign film that was innovative and cool and unique, and like everybody who saw it was like, oh my God, this thing's amazing. And Plan B, I guess, got a hold of it. And of course, it was remade as The Departed. So a lot of people saw The Departed, which is an Oscar-winning movie with huge stars and Martin Scorsese, and don't know that it's based on this also very good movie. It's hard to do that, but they definitely pulled it off because they all put their own print on it. I don't know with Downhill. I think that was kind of it was that, right? That's kind of the attempt.
There was just no way for me to watch it without thinking about Force Majeure. So for me, it was just a total warped experience. you know, just because you're thinking about the other film, and I'd even watched it recently, so I really had it on the top of my brain. But you know, I was able to sit down with Nat Faxon and Jim Rash, and they did talk about like why they made it. And it turns out Julia Louis-Dreyfus, she was kind of pushing that, which is kind of interesting because, without giving too much away, the one significant difference other than the story being told from like an American cultural perspective being in Austria, you do get to see a lot more from the wife, Billy's perspective, which was something that did not exist in Force Majeure.
And what that, I feel good about that because that was sort of my guess, was I thought she's a producer and maybe she wanted to tell this story, but to inject it with more perspective from more of the woman's perspective and make her more of a lead. And they did do that, I think, effectively.
And those were probably some of the funniest parts, those original things where you got to see her character doing some pretty unusual and funny and edgy things in this otherwise familiar script and storyline. So, you know, you know, go to nofilmschool.com and check out the print interview for that one. They talk a little bit more about their process. But that was an interesting one for sure in terms of audiences taking away completely different things from the movie.
Yeah. I mean, so I saw – there's two that I would talk about. One was Horse Girl, which I mentioned because it was another example of – even though that's a Netflix movie, you're going to see it if you want. It'll be out soon. Like very soon, I think. But it's about mental health. It's about like mental illness. And if you've been close to or experienced mental illness, or you've known somebody who's gone through it and their reality has started to fracture and you can only see it from the outside, it feels a certain way. They tried to bring us into the inside of it a little bit, which is a little bit of a horror film in a way. And also just, I mean, there's comedic elements. It has a lot of it has Alison Brie. It has Molly Shannon, but it's dark and disturbing, and I think that it's an example of another example of where Sundance is looking to give audiences an experience they're not used to having, to opening up an experience that is not as familiar to them through cinema. So it's like I haven't seen it done that way before, and it did remind me of people I've known who suffered with mental health issues in a pretty dramatic and horrific way. So that was interesting.
I think it's called Dream Horse, right? Not Horse Girl.
No, oh, there's also two. So there's Dream Horse and there's Horse both. Girl.
Oh, yeah. I was like, George. Yeah.
I know Horse Girl is a title where you're like, really? It's called Horse Girl, I hope. No, it really is.
Because I heard Dream Horse was bad, so I was like, oh, interesting.
I saw Dream Horse. I saw both horse movies. I'm the equine.
You're going to get so many emails about covering horse films from now on.
That's another subgenre we could talk about. Dream Horse, a whole other story. I also wanted to talk about The Last Shift, which is a movie. Ryan spoke with the filmmaker, Andrew Cohen, and we're going to have that interview up on the podcast. And I highly encourage everyone to listen to it because I think that this movie and this filmmaker are really exciting. I think this movie does something that I personally want to see when I go to movies. It's about an extremely important, timely issue and issues, but it's narrative driven. It's not preachy. It doesn't offer answers, but it really does a good job showing you sides of a problem we're all becoming extremely familiar with, which has to do with race and class in small town America and middle America, and the way those things interact between two guys who are working at a fast food place together. And then, like that, that sounds like a lot, but it pulls it off in a really measured, straightforward way that makes it about characters and people. And it's honestly, it's bold because it touches on stuff that's like really touchy right now, nerve wise. And
what, for example?
Hate crimes, racism, so the idea, I think, that at the kernel of it that I felt like, wow, that's kind of like a hot thing to touch right now is kind of like it's not. So the idea of the white working class voter, the forgotten man, that became a big issue in the 2016 election, I feel like. And the idea that maybe liberalism was leaving behind the white person who also suffers and focusing only on the person of color. And I think that is a really complicated thing to get into and to try and present narrative-wise without taking sides. I really think it manages to pull it off because, you know, this is also about poverty in a way. It's about a forgotten part of the country and the people there who still try to make a living, and it's struggling. And there's also, so there's, it's a two-hander, as we say in the screenwriting world and that, or the movie world, that it's a two protagonists really with mirrored arcs. And one is a young African-American man who's dealing with coming out of jail, and he is intelligent. He's a writer. He's like, and then it's dealing with an older white man who's retiring, and they're kind of crossing over in the same job. They're taking turns.
Very interesting.
It touches and it's weird. They start off closer than you would think, but as you go deeper, they start to run into. I want Ryan to talk about it because he talked to the director. I'm talking about it just out of my ass, but hey, I think I know a few things about what makes movies good.
No, I think George is absolutely right. I would agree with all those touch points, and you know, the fact that it navigates this gray area is what makes it's what makes movies great, because you can have empathy for a character who's making mistakes or is in the wrong. And I think one of the common things we've seen among the movies we're talking about is that a lot of them are coming from personal places, either geographically, where a filmmaker is from somewhere so they know it, or dealing with mental illness, or dealing with the death of a loved one. So The Last Shift, Andrew Cohn is from the Midwest.
Yeah.
And he's done a lot of documentaries, and I've known him for a while, and this was his first narrative, and he's just, you know, an independent filmmaker who wrote a lot of drafts, was trying to get his movie made, cold emailed Alexander Payne's assistant, Alexander Payne, who did Election in Nebraska and so many amazing films, and, didn't get a response, was just trying to get his movie made. And then 3 months later, the phone rings, and Alexander Payne says, "Hey, I'd like to direct your movie. The script is great." So it's a really great story, and ultimately, Alexander Payne was busy making other movies, so he supported Andrew with identifying producers and putting them together. And then those producers, they elevate your script to something that's going to be real when producers like Albert Berger and Ron Yerxa come on board to make your film. So all of a sudden, he's got Academy Award nominee Richard Jenkins in
who's
the lead role.
Who's amazing.
He's incredible.
And I want to say real quick, please also, this is part of why I thought that the Producers Roundtable was so important. If you're listening and you're no film school reader or something, there's so much value to get from getting the right producers if your idea is there. And I think Ryan sort of just highlighted, because like this movie is it's really well made visually for a first-time director. It's well lit and it's unique looking, I thought. And it's got Alexander Payne in its DNA for sure. So it makes sense. But
and look out for that podcast, because it's there's a lot of really valuable tips. They only shot it in 20 days, so the fact that it's so intentional and the fact that everything looks, you know, the blocking and the staging and the framing and everything is so intentional is a testament to. What I heard a lot from Andrew was just how open he was to listening. And sometimes I think as a first time director, you can say, "I know what I'm doing, you know, get off my back." And, he was really open to asking people questions. I mean, he called me beforehand and said, you know, what can go wrong? And I remember thinking like everything.
Did you give him script notes?
No, I mean, I read a draft, but he did so many drafts. The script was so good. It was one of those things where someone sends you a script and you're like, oh, this is going to be something. So yeah, look out for that
podcast.
Come on,
take some credit.
I don't know when. I said, hey, you should get Richard Jenkins. No, I have nothing to do with it whatsoever. But I'm not sure when that podcast will run, but look out for it, because we always – also, it's also great to see somebody make the leap – not leap, because you know it's only one is better than the other, but to transition from documentary to narrative. And he talks a lot about how being a documentary filmmaker, how helpful it was for him as a first-time narrative director, how much experience he had and how much he could bring to it, having done so many documentaries.
I've heard that so much.
Yeah. In this, particularly at this year?
No, in general, just talking to filmmakers. And I think you can tell when someone's been a documentary filmmaker because they understand people's nuances.
I was going to say, it actually makes sense, thinking about the movie now, the way it was shot and the coverage and some of the, like, yeah. Yeah.
And the attention to people's behavior and sort of like the anthropological aspect of filmmaking, where we're all just studying each other because humans are so weird and interesting.
Oakley's nodding as a documentary filmmaker.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to, you know, now that I've completely figured out documentary, now I'm trying to translate what I've learned into narrative. And it's also kind of like you feel like you're not prepared because you've spent a lot of time learning this one specific type of filmmaking, but also there's all these lessons that you have that the people who haven't gone through what you have just can't even understand. So hopefully that's something I might try experimenting. So I got to check out this podcast, see how I can translate that and figure that out for
myself.
You
should check out the movie. Yeah.
I want to.
This podcast is sponsored by Rode Microphones, the Australian pro audio powerhouse making incredible gear for podcasters, vloggers, filmmakers, and musicians. Rode is at the vanguard of innovation for audio solutions for podcasters, offering groundbreaking products like the Rodecaster Pro, the world's first fully integrated podcast production studio, and PodMic, the ultimate podcasting microphone. Find out more about how Rode can help you cut through the noise at rode.com/podcasting. That's rode.com/podcasting. This podcast was recorded using Rode microphones and technology. Founded by a group of independent filmmakers, Small HD has been innovating the on-camera and production monitor industry for an entire decade. It started by creating the first ever HD monitor that could sit on top of a DSLR. Today, its products include the 703 Bolt that has an integrated wireless receiver and a daylight viewable screen. Small HD is in the business of providing real-time confidence for creatives. With an extremely wide range of field monitors, Small HD prides itself on durability and usability. Whether it's paired with a mirrorless camera during a wedding or used for Video Village in Hollywood, Small HD has a monitor for every production. Powerful software tools, a unified user experience, and premium display quality help make Small HD monitors the industry standard. Stop wondering if you've nailed the shot. Start having more confidence at the camera with Small HD. On-camera and production monitors starting at just $299. For more information about Small HD products, go to smallhd.com.
What has everyone, like, I feel like we sort of started talking about visuals there, but I'm curious, because this is no film school, and a lot of our people, our community loves visuals, what have been the visual kind of standouts? I ask partly because I'm curious, because I haven't seen a ton of stuff. I certainly haven't seen 16 movies, but I haven't seen enough to really say, like, oh, well, because I did come out of the last shift, there were certain scenes where they did in low light that and like some really shallow depth of field that like was my taste visually, that I was like, ooh, I love that look. But like, I'm curious what people saw that grabbed them from a visual standpoint.
Well, just to piggyback on the documentary conversation, I saw a doc that was exquisitely shot. It's called The Truffle Hunters, and it actually just got bought by Sony Pictures Classics. I did the interview today, and it was two co-directors who said that they shot one shot per day, and that was because I know
Ryan just fell out of his chair.
No, it's a documentary, but you know,
Michael Fleck was one of the co-directors, right?
Yes,
I remember he did The Last Race, which we covered a couple years ago.
Exactly.
Okay. Look for that one.
Some real specific visual style from the beginning.
The reason why they were able to do that, which I'll get into in the interview itself, is because they had spent so much time in this tiny, remote, very predictable town in Italy, and they knew the rhythms of it so well. They knew their characters, what they did every day, what, you know,
hunt
what
truffles.
Yeah, they're truffle hunters. It's like this ancient profession. auction for this extremely expensive Alba truffle that can only be found. It only grows in Italy, and you can't manufacture its growth anywhere else.
Wow.
Anyway, their visual approach was incredible because everything was locked down. It was all static shots. And it was so brilliantly composed. And every location that they went to looked like it had been art directed to perfection, but really it was just these incredible people's lives, and they just had an eye for it. They knew what to look for and how to frame their characters.
That reminds me, after this, I do want to talk about production design and art direction in Sundance a little bit, because I had a thought that I want to bounce out there, but go, let's keep talking.
Yeah, I think visually I want to talk about some movies that I think are also fantastic films, because you know, visuals alone, no one goes to the movie theater to watch pretty cinematography for 2 hours. You'll be bored pretty quickly. But so Zola is Janitza Bravo's film, based on 144 tweets. But it really effectively bottles the internet on screen in a movie theater. And it's not just a matter of putting phone graphics and having sound effects from Twitter and that kind of thing on there. It's a Florida set, or at least they get to Florida at a certain point, road movie, and it's just hyperkinetic, and the colors and the characters and the costume design, like everything jumps off the screen, the way it's edited. It's just a really, it's a visual treat, and it manages to sustain this kind of momentum that it starts off at a breakneck pace and then basically goes until the end, and you're always left wondering what's happening next.
That was the experience of reading the Twitter thread too, which I think is awesome.
Yeah, so a programmer off the record I was talking to here, and we were talking about how people are depicting stuff on our phones in movies because it's becoming so much of how we spend our days.
You mean you were just talking offline? This isn't like top secret, off the record stuff.
I'm just saying that because it's not – I said that because it's not an interview that I can now also plug for people to find elsewhere on No Film School's platform. But maybe I'll talk to her later somewhere on No Film School. But the point being that she was talking about how Zola really – goes for it in terms of, you know, we've seen it done so many ways and it doesn't always work, right? Like, it doesn't always recreate the experience we have, but it sounds like this time it did.
Absolutely. Another film that I will mention, and I think Oakley saw it, is The Mountains Are a Dream That Call to Me.
Yes.
Which is a docu-hybrid-mentary narrative.
And we do have an interview coming with the filmmaker on it. He can kind of elaborate a little on his dogma, but yeah.
More Asian love here. It's set in the Annapurna Mountains.
He's a chief lighting technician on all these fantastic films, and this is his first feature.
I did not know that.
I hope that's in the piece.
Oh yeah, that is.
Yeah.
So this was in the next section, I believe, which is, you know, sort of usually lower budget, formerly adventurous, sometimes youthful films. This was kind of a documentary, but not really. I don't know. Go see it. It's something to see in the theater because the rhythms of the film, it sort of transfixes you, and it uses visuals a lot. I mean, obviously, if you're in the Annapurna Mountains, it's just it's like a moving postcard, and it's something to see in a theater because if you put that on at home in the living room on Netflix, 7 seconds into it, you're going to be like, oh, what was that thing on my phone that I was doing? So, you know, movies, you really have to give yourself over to them, some more than others. And this is a movie where it's somebody hiking and there's a lot of sound design and just a lot of ideas visually in it that I found really appealing. I'm going to go through some more quickly because then I have to run. Possessor is David Cronenberg's son, Brandon Cronenberg's film that visually...
Fantastic visually.
Yeah.
Production design, maybe.
Yes. It was one of those things where it was like a midnight screening and I was like, am I just really tired? Or you can't, you know, I wasn't like fully engaged with everything. I thought the performances are great. The production design is incredible. Mm-hmm. There are big ideas in the film. And certainly if you remove the first name of the director, you could still say, oh, this is a Cronenberg film. I mean, there's some of the same cloth at work there with what he's interested in.
I interviewed him.
Nice. Yeah. Is that a written piece or a podcast?
Let the readers know. And I will put it up soon.
Wendy is Ben Zeitlin's new film after 7 or 8 years in production. It's very – his first film was, you know, obviously a breakout – Beasts of the Southern Wild. Wendy is also a similar aesthetic, and it's kids, and it's, you know, magical realism, and it's retelling the tale of Peter Pan from Wendy's perspective. And it's really interesting. I'm curious how it does out in the world, but you know, these kids swimming to an island, there are, it's very visual. There are things where you just go, how do they do that? Like, was that safe? You know, these kids are in like crashing waves and jumping off of things, and the visuals of that are also amazing. And I also want to talk mention Charm City Kings, which is, it's not really based on, there was a documentary called 12 O'Clock Boys about the motorcyclists in Baltimore who would, Lofty Nathan directed it. And this movie
They're turning it into a narrative.
This is the narrative.
This is the narrative? Oh my God, I'm just finding this out now.
But it's not based on, like, it's based on that world, but the story is the characters they've created. I know Barry Jenkins did a draft of the script, and then Overbrook Entertainment, Will Smith's company, produced it, and it's got some fantastic performances. The cinematography is amazing. You go in thinking this is going to be an independent film, and then you realize, oh, it was like a big production company, because we're doing like a car chase sequence through the streets of Baltimore with bikes and police cars, and things are crashing. And
cool.
But it's very, very visual. And yeah, I guess that's it, because I already talked about Minari and 9 Days. That's all I got.
Okay. You have anything you wanna add to your Sundance experience before you log off? I mean, people can find the interviews you've done as well. They'll be coming out soon, and the roundtables. Oh,
there's one more I should mention, which would be a good toss to what's coming, which is Omniboat, a fast boat Fantasia. So this is we have a podcast coming in the days immediately to follow. This is an omnibus film with 15 different filmmakers, including a lot of recognizable names. But one of the great things that I'm looking forward to about releasing the podcast is it was originally based, the film opens with a credit based on a PDF by Lucas Leiva. And obviously I've never seen that opening credit before. So the PDF is bananas, and I was able to get them to send it to us. So we're going to publish that on No Film School with the podcast.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And the PDF is all about how they wanted to hang out on a boat, and they, with independent film investment not being particularly lucrative, why not buy a boat instead or in addition to a film? So anyway, this PDF will be on the website, and they offered up their film for acquisition at the premiere, as well as the speedboat that is in the movie throughout. So it's a really, you know, the PDF itself is like the tone of the movie, and it's completely gonzo. And so we're going to release that podcast soon, and then, you know, make sure to tune in for the gonzo PDF to go with it.
Cool.
And with that, see you guys.
He bows
it's been
out.
It's been a great Sundance. There have been so many great movies here, and if you hear otherwise, don't believe it.
All right. Oakley, visuals?
Visuals, I mean, to be completely honest, the coolest visually innovative stuff I've seen has been in the shorts.
Yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, I just haven't, you know, I don't know if it's because it's shorter and you're able to do more with less money or less time, but, you know, we did two podcasts, two roundtables with short filmmakers and midnight short filmmakers, and my God, they're doing some really cool things in their shorts where I'm just like, oh yes, I just want to keep watching this. And the style is definitely probably overshadowed most of the features that I've seen.
Nice.
Just in,
well, I highly encourage everybody to take a look at those, because the shorts are also, like, there's a couple opportunities with shorts to get involved. There's going to be Sundance Ignite, which we're going to have a piece up about, and that application involves a short in the short challenge, and that's coming up in February. And then there's going to be a Kickstarter short month, which we have a piece up about, and that's going to be in March. So there's going there's going to be a lot of opportunities for people who want to make shorts to make them and get into these kind of avenues. And the fact that Oakley interviewed all these short filmmakers, and you'll be able to hear from all of them about it. And she says they're visually impressive.
They really are. Yeah. And I'm just really excited. I'm like, I don't know if this is a fluke or if we just happen to talk to all these people that are really doing something interesting, but I'm excited to see you, to follow these people's careers, because, and to copy their ideas and steal them for myself. But it was really cool to
great
see their work.
Steal.
Right? That's basically all I do. And also literally I'm just stealing free candy bars at every free Sundance stop I can.
Oakley, the pilferer.
Yes. I would probably steal the toilet paper if I wasn't leaving early. but yeah. And In terms of features, some features have already been mentioned that I thought looked cool, but I'll mention another one. La Leyenda Negra.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I've heard a lot about this. This is a very DIY, too.
Yeah, right? So that's the director's first feature, and she's also working with first-time non-actors who are teenagers.
Nice.
And it's in black and white. Wow. What could go wrong?
Not on film.
It could be not on film. No.
Yeah, that would be cool.
They want to do, but everybody wants to. And,
yeah.
And something about it just really works as a story. And one thing that I was able to interview her a little about the process. And one thing that was cool that I thought that's a great takeaway, especially dealing with being new in so many areas and shooting in black and white. Well, I guess the black and white just happened to look great and interesting. What she did is she didn't storyboard. She literally shot the film just with a little tiny handheld camera with her actors and then edited it and then sent that to the DP. So they didn't have a storyboard. They had like the whole film they shot ahead of time, like the rehearsal. Essentially, the rehearsal was shot.
That's part of what Roger Deakins did on 1917, which you can find that interview, what I did with him on No Film School. But yeah, I think more and more people are doing that. And you know, Orson Welles says, you can't make a good movie if it's not black and white. Or said, I guess he's not with us anymore. But yeah, I mean, I'm always down for black and white. If people are doing it, I'm
excited. If they do it right. And
yeah.
I'm always surprised because sometimes you associate black and white film with a certain tone for some reason. I don't know why, but you think that way. And every time I see a good black and white, I'm like, oh my God, black and white can be this way and black and white can be that way. And you kind of forget that living in a color world.
Every genre
it used
that
to be
existed.
Every
yeah.
genre, in exactly.
Fact, yeah, black and white doesn't need to be noir or Raging Bull or anything. It can just be a choice that changes the palette and the look. I visually didn't have anything that really, like, I wanted to hear from everyone else. I saw a few good things and I mentioned some of them. But I also notice, I do feel like there continue to be, even in the movies that have unique perspective, indie movie tropes that I'm getting to the point, you know, to some extent where I'm a little bit like, I think we should stop doing these. I'm not king of indie movies, but sometimes I see them and I'm like, I feel like we should generally, like, there's a lot of indie movies that seem to start, especially Sundance movies, with like, this is this character's daily routine. I was like, why is this still the way? Like, I'd like to see people break format a little bit more. And I also noticed art direction-wise and production design-wise that I see certain things that feel like they're becoming kind of familiar patterns in terms of, like, the way people are costumed almost and the way that there's, like, kind of like a flat makeup style. And I think sometimes it's an effort to dress things down, to de-emphasize the movie-dumb of them. But I'm curious about it because I didn't see as much, I think, certainly as Ryan, but as you guys. And I just wonder if there are thoughts on that or maybe counterpoints to it. But I just felt like even in Downhill, which isn't indie really, but I still felt like it was like they're fitting into this certain rhythm and style and pacing. That it's, I mean, it sounds like Zola's totally blows that open, you know, and like black and white, of course. So I'm sure there are plenty of exceptions, but I do feel like there's a certain, it's almost becoming like there's genre conventions to a Sundance movie in some filmmakers' minds. And I'd like to hear if people also experience that.
I've seen that more in previous years. Granted, I didn't see a ton of very typical Sundance fare this year. I kind of tried to
Good.
Yeah. but it might have been because I didn't see those movies,
yeah,
you know, so
yeah.
I don't want to say it definitively.
You put them on my list and you took them off your list, so that's what I'm realizing.
Perhaps
okay, that's
that
cool. No, that's cool.
Busted.
We have a list of things we're trying to cover.
Yeah, we made an effort to split up so we could try to cover for everybody all the different kinds of things because there's so much. I hope we did a good job of it this year. The idea is that there's so much at Sundance, it's kind of impossible to see everything. But as Ryan has mentioned a few times as well, you could come and see a few things that only fit in one of the boxes here and be like, oh, Sundance is just this. And that's kind of what I was saying. I was trying to say, like, did everybody find enough variety that they could say, like, Sundance is not just this. Sundance is all these different things. Because I think it's important also to represent that to people on the outside that there's a lot of different things happening here that don't fit into the same boxes, right?
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to think of what to say to that, but I haven't seen as many narratives as I've seen docs. And
yeah.
The narratives I have seen have been sort of not super conventional in some of those ways, like I mentioned on the last podcast, Summertime, yeah, which is like a vignette the whole way through based on spoken word. So, you know, they're kind of, I haven't seen a lot of narratives, although I have in the past, like Emily said, where these conventions are there. And I'm trying to think, there are similar things that happen in documentary where you're like, right, okay, we're cutting away to the graphic and the dramatic music comes on. Yeah. Like there's certain conventions. I don't know if they're necessarily bad. You know,
No, I'm not making a judgment per se. I mean, it sounds like I am. I think what I'm saying is like, I like to be, and especially at a film festival, I think we all like to be surprised a little bit and we like to see people pushing things. And I think that, you know, I want to see if people, what, I think we've talked a little bit about a few of those things that were like, I've never seen somebody do that before. It sounds like Zola was definitely one of those. But I want to know more about people who can highlight things for us that are like, hey, for what, for the rest of the world, when this, if and when this becomes available, this is one of those things that tests the boundaries and that does things cinematically that you don't see other places. Because, you know, going back to like our prior roundtable podcast about the business side a little bit, because the room in the mainstream for a drama has shrunk, that it, the festivals sometimes are the place where drama, feature length drama, exists. It's not like a mainstream, it's not in multiplexes as much anymore. So that's kind of like what I'm talking about. And I just feel like, who saw, did you guys see stuff that you felt like pushed the boundaries a lot?
I do think that, I talked about this film last time on the podcast, Shirley by Josephine Decker, but she's pushed the boundaries in a similar way in her previous films. But I do think that she's utterly singular. Like, her version of making a film is nobody else's. It's not derivative. It's totally manic. It's really hyper and exciting. And all of the elements combine to make this really, you know, almost stressful experience. Not in a Safdie Brothers kind of way, but because what's happening on screen isn't necessarily stressful, but what is, you know, the subjectivity of the characters and what is happening to them inside is being depicted on screen.
That's cool. Okay, everybody, we're going to turn back the clock now to a prior point in the podcast, and we're talking about acquisition. So a lot of big deals have already closed here.
And interestingly, it was very quiet for the first 3 days of the festival, which is not normal. So I think everyone was kind of concerned about how that might pan out in the long term. But in the past 2 or 3 days now, I guess, how long have we been here? We've been here for years.
Feels like
time
a long
passes
time.
Differently here. Yeah. It's like Inception. Or no, not Inception. Sorry. The other movie where Matthew McConaughey is in space. You know the meme where he's like, it's every second is an hour here. It's been a lot. We've been here a long time. But the point is, yes, the first weekend's crazy. And that whole idea of the bidding wars in the theaters wasn't really happening and the big deals weren't happening. But
now things are happening in a big way. And this is something that I'm going to write a more analytical piece about with some reporting from the ground on with talking to buyers. And you can read that eventually. But one thing that I've noticed about the deals this year is that there's last year, it was a lot of people were concerned about the theatrical versus streaming situation. A lot of filmmakers did not want to give their film over to a streaming service. For example, The Farewell director, Lulu Wang, she got an offer that was significantly higher than what she ultimately went with, which was A24. She went with A24 because she thought they were going to give her a really good theatrical release, and the other offer apparently was more of a streaming platform.
But it was more lucrative.
But it was more lucrative.
Yeah.
So she...
This is just a microcosm of a major issue we're seeing across the industry the last few years, which is like streaming, Netflix and The Irishman, and like, where do you want to be and where a movie's supposed to be seen and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lot going on there. But so, the idea being there's like the hybrid deal now.
Right. So the course correction this year is that I think that streaming platforms and theatrical distributors are realizing that they have something to be gained by working together rather than competing directly, especially at Sundance. So there have been a couple pretty high profile buys in that model. One of them is Neon and Hulu, which bought Palm Springs for $15 million. 68 more cents than the record of Sundance buys, which obviously...
I thought it was 69 cents.
Oh, I think it was 69. Wow, that is a real...
Then we have to make the nice joke.
Wow, sorry. I was trying to avoid...
Oh. Emily didn't want to go there. I think what... So we're definitely going to have content with some of the Palm Springs creators, and we have... We'll have a post coming that's an interview. We also had one of the editors here talking to Oakley.
Matt Friedman, who edited The Farewell as well, edited Palm Springs, and he was here talking this morning on the editor's roundtable, and he talks a little bit about how he got involved in the project. So definitely check out the editor's roundtable podcast. That's actually my favorite podcast of the whole fest.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have a lot of post-production people, but back to the acquisitions side of this. There's inflation. Numbers go up, but the biggest deal ever, that's a big deal.
It is. And I think it's just funny how tongue-in-cheek they were being about, like, oh, this is the biggest deal ever. But
by cents. Yeah. Yeah. But still, I mean, I think it's worthwhile to point out to filmmakers everywhere at every level. I know you're not winning the lottery like five times over, getting the biggest deal Sundance. But the point being, there's still a lot of money being thrown around.
Does this mean that like Hulu is a bigger player in this year's fest than in past years? Because they brought the Hillary doc.
Good point.
So I don't recall Hulu, being a huge player before.
Hulu.
What's their deal?
Belongs to Disney.
So are they changing course because of that?
Well, there may just be deeper pockets, ultimately.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay.
I mean, there was a time, ago when Hulu was like, Hulu's buying stuff. They need stuff. But it was small.
Well, last year, Apple bought stuff. Amazon buys stuff.
Apple bought Apple and A24 was another hybrid acquisition. They bought Boys State for, I believe, $12 million. Yes. And A24 has had hybrid deals before. They also are here selling films, which I think is a really interesting model as well.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a, yeah.
So they're really just in all layers of the game.
Wasn't our joke last year that it was like the A24 festival? Mm-hmm. I mean, this year feels definitely less so, but they are a big presence here.
They really are.
This is becoming their business model, is movies coming out of here and movies that they bring here. And I think it's just worth pointing out that a lot of money is still exchanging hands on movies here. So, I guess that's not a huge surprise maybe, but I think that the business models in the industry are changing so rapidly and so dramatically that it's worth pointing out that there's, like you said, a course correction. And was that a doc? There was a
Boys State.
There's a big doc purchase.
There is.
Yeah.
And even docs that are getting relatively smaller purchases, like, for example, The Truffle Hunters got bought by Sony Pictures Classics for $1.5 million. That's more like of a traditional Sundance Sun. There probably wasn't a bidding war.
Is it a theatrical as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but that's, I think, really awesome. I mean, it's good that the lower end of the market is still healthy too, because you don't want this, huge discrepancy between
just
these inflated prices.
I think it's also cool that they're working in these theatricals, because they're seeing that, like, look, the reality is the theatrical is not where the money is made. So that's why those offers are going to be lower, and for some of these movies, they're going to be less existent. And for those of us on the in another part of the industry, we know that if you sell a movie to a distributor, it's really for streaming platforms around the world. It's not for cable sometimes, or like PVOD, but it's not going to be for a theatrical release. But it's cool to know that there are efforts at the high level, but hopefully at other levels too, to be like, yeah, we want to get a movie in theaters a little bit too. And the filmmakers may drive some of that, because if people like Lulu Wang don't want to take a deal that's more money because they really want their movie in a theater, that affects the rest of us.
For sure. I was talking to my friend who works in acquisitions at Netflix last night, and she was reminding me that Uncut Gems, which we all think about as a theatrical film, it had a great theatrical release, it was
Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. And we think about it as an A24 film because that's what it was. But Netflix actually owns the international rights to that film.
Whoa.
So everyone else in the world sees it as a Netflix film.
Was it is it streaming internationally?
Not yet, but will
okay.
be.
And was Netflix, do you know if Netflix was involved on that movie from the beginning?
I doubt it.
That's
but
interesting.
I will find out.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that movie is a really interesting model, just because it has a huge star who's got a big deal with Netflix, or has, And there's a funny side thing, which is like people were watching it because of the star and then totally terrified because it's not an Adam Sandler movie in the traditional sense. But it's weird that that's like, you know, one of the ways that filmmakers who aren't having their projects seen as much get their projects seen with the big star, you know, all of that.
Maybe that's a Sundance trope. Like actors well known for a certain thing come to do their indie role.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. That's I mean, but it's also like we talked about a little bit last time. How Sundance can only support things that nobody's heard of with filmmakers who are new, trying different things, because there's it's like what's gonna wag the dog, so to speak. It's gonna be that there's something with Will Ferrell. So like it there is an important symbiotic relationship between. Why, like, high-level things or high, I shouldn't say high-level, high-budget things with big names and faces that, like, help them support the rest of the infrastructure, yeah. You know?
And Will Ferrell gets to act in a way that some people aren't used to seeing him, and then, you know, that's...
I would say, like, I don't know if you guys had this experience with anything you saw, but for me, like, Richard Jenkins is a great actor, and it's really fun to see him in a movie where he gets to really... dig in like The Last Shift and do this big performance and this big character, this great piece that, you know, he's not leading. He's not going to get those parts. Those parts aren't, you know, out in the mainstream necessarily. But this is just a cool, like, I don't know. I love that there's that place for them to do things. And stars are really important. Like, great actors are important to movies. Like, Alison Brie in this Horse Girl is another, like, she gets a chance in Aubrey Plaza in Black Bear. You get a chance to see really talented people who are known for only doing certain things do things that you didn't know they could do, but they're actors. So, and it's fun to see that.
Did you like Black Bear, by the way?
Yeah, I did. I interviewed Lawrence Michael Levine, and that's live. I actually interviewed him in an Uber, which was fun and weird and different.
is so Sundance.
Yeah, it was just like, I was like, hey man, I'm along for the ride. Let's do this. Like, it was like he didn't have time, and we had to get to his next screening, and we had a lot of fun. It's a very interesting movie, and he was really clear with me. He did not want us to spoil some of what happens because it does things that are completely unexpected, and that's fun to see. It's about filmmakers. It's about creative people in a variety of ways, of an actress who makes movies and a musician, and like, it's got a very unique perspective on how relationships can or can't work within the context of trying to be creative. And I know in our community, so this is in the piece I wrote, but we have a lot of people sometimes who ask, like, how do you, and I've seen it on Reddit, like, how do you have a relationship in and pursue these things? Because it's really not easy. And I think the movie talks about that in a really interesting kind of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf style way. And when I mentioned that movie, he was like, yes, I love that movie. So it's like, if that's kind of your thing, then you'd be really into it. It's just cool to see an actress like Aubrey Plaza too be put in a position where she does stuff that, you know, she has her thing she does really well that we've seen before, and she gets to do that here, but she also gets to do all this other stuff. Same with Alison Brie, same with a lot of these, like, same with Will Ferrell, I would say, right? So I think that's kind of like, if you want to find the silver lining to the star side of Sundance, that's what it is. It's like, you can come to Sundance and see movies with stars, or at least character actors that put them in new places.
Yeah,
you know?
They get to get outside of the box they've been placed in.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Thanks everyone who's listened to our Sundance coverage from Sundance on No Film School. Please like and subscribe to the podcast. Comment, let us know what you're into, and check back, because there's going to be a ton of other content from Sundance. Interviews with a lot of the filmmakers we've been talking about, a lot of the films we've talked about. We're going to cover it in print on nofilmschool.com, so you can see it there. We're also going to have a lot of really cool interviews with all of these people. And irrespective of whether or not you see these movies, I think there's a lot you can get out of these roundtables and these interviews and this content. So we're really excited about it, and we hope you enjoyed our coverage this year. And thanks so much.
Yeah, watch out. The barrage is coming.
Yeah, it's all there. Stuff's already there for you to look at.
Yeah.